finished a maybe a 2 month or so practice period at San Francisco Zen Center, just finished Rohatsu Sesshin there, and what does she do? Come here. Catch another one. A couple days ago, during this session, a newsletter arrived at our mailbox here from the Berkeley Zen Center, and it has an article by Sojin Mel Weitzman Roshi, the abbot at Berkeley Zen Center, and this part of a talk is called The Fourth Day of Rohatsu. Now, today is the third day for us, and maybe the second day for some of us, and the first day for some of us. So I thought it might be nice to wait till the fourth day tomorrow to read a little bit of this. But it's about practicing with physical pain. So I thought I'd spare you having to wait another day to hear this, because I think it's encouraging. Because you might be experiencing some physical difficulty. And he begins saying, to begin, I want to remind us about breathing. I know you won't forget to breathe. Whether you forget or not, you will breathe. But I want to remind us to allow our breath to be deep, and to let go of tension when we find our breath rising up in our chest. When you don't know what else to do, when you have pain in zazen, rather than uncrossing your legs, you might try putting some strength in your lower abdomen when you exhale. Then a conversation ensues with a student who asks, if you don't know what to do and you don't want to uncross your legs, do you just grit your teeth and bear it? And Sojin Roshi says, instead of gritting your teeth, try letting go. You can't fight it. It's not a battle. It's a letting go. Whatever appears, let it be. There's a saying, the cool breeze blows through the empty hall. The only approach that works is to open up and let whatever appears just pass through. And then this persistent student says, but is it better to uncross your legs than to fight it? Almost kind of like, this letting go practice, it's too much, or it's too little. It's too difficult. It's too intangible. He kind of ignores the advice, it seems to me, this point about letting go. Well then, but is it better to uncross your legs than to fight it? And replying to this, since he's not going to directly just let go, this is a surprising answer, I thought. That Mel says, no, it's better to fight it than uncross your legs. This is the spirit we sometimes must arouse in Sesshin. It's better to fight it than uncross your legs. Of course, the initial instruction is, just let go, like a cool breeze blowing through an empty hall. Better to fight it, otherwise you'll never find your way. You have to go through your battles. This is sometimes called the battleground of the heart and mind. It's also been called the comfortable way. You have to go through your battles until you give up and let go. So let your mind follow your breath. The first thing is posture. Establish your posture. But I thought that's an interesting point. You have to go through your battles until you give up and let go. And if we don't go directly into the battle, we may not have the chance to really let go, because we don't need to let go if we're not in the midst of facing our life and death like this. Now, this is maybe kind of masculine imagery, right? Fighting your desire to be comfortable and going into the battleground of the heart and mind. So I don't know how we could put it in a more feminine way at the same time. Yes.
I think day five I had the most difficult day, and I said that I was hanging on by a thread. Mm-hmm. And so I was hanging on by a thread for a while, and a couple periods later it occurred to me to let go of the thread. So
that's a great image. Yeah. Yeah, and if I let go of this thread, I might just actually evaporate or die completely. And of course, how wonderful to evaporate and die completely. But we have our fear is strong to let go in such a way.
If the Zafu has a leak. You don't want to just let go of the thread.
If the Zafu has a leak.
Yeah, this Zafu had a little tiny hole. Worrying about it.
I think there's I've heard there's this phrase in Japan, when a young monk goes off to the monastery, they have this phrase, something like, break a zafu. The parents maybe tell them, or the grandparents, go break a zafu. Like, what do we have in English? There's some,
break a leg.
Break a leg, yeah, like break a leg. Sashin, maybe not so good to break a leg, but break a zafu, it's okay. If you completely destroy that zafu, we'll just give you another one. Don't let it worry you. Well, maybe another, instead of a battle, you know, I think of, I don't know, the experience of women giving childbirth, you know, this great struggle, painful struggle. But it's probably more in the lines of letting go, and it's not even a conscious, like, I really have to let go now. It's right. I would imagine more like total surrender. Like, just like, let nature take its course here. Surrender. As we chanted just before the talk, we shall renounce worldly affairs and maintain the Buddha Dharma. This is Dogen's vow that we chant. And people often ask, well, what's this worldly affairs we're renouncing? And in this case, when sitting zazen in discomfort, the worldly affairs is all the thoughts of how to manipulate the situation, how to improve it, make it better, and so on. And renounce just means let go. Worldly affairs could also be the thoughts in zazen that just pull us away from the present. It could be anything. It could be just about rabbits. Mel says, we should have a sign over the Zendo door that says, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. anything we hope for is a problem. Our resistance is the problem. We usually have to go through many painful, difficult periods of zazen until we allow ourselves to let go. That's why 7 days is a good opportunity, because it wears us down. A student says, I keep hoping that the pain will go away as the week goes on. And he says, that's the problem. That's why it doesn't go away. Anything we hope for is a problem. Give up hope of anything you want. The second noble truth says, wanting is the cause of suffering. When we say, I wish it would go away, that's the cause of our suffering. Having what we don't want is the cause of suffering. Zazen is to drop body and mind, let go of ego, let go of self. It's not just words. We have big, strong egos which keep us from realization. The important thing is to be compassionate with yourself and not to blame your surroundings, not to blame the practice. Sometimes we have people come to Sesshin and blame us for making them do these things. The most compassionate thing we can do is look for the problem within ourselves and at the same time not blame ourselves for it. When we really take on our own suffering and our own difficulty, we have compassion for everyone. We look around and see that everybody's having a hard time and we feel compassion for their difficulty. The suffering that we're going through is the basis of our enlightenment. I know that's not what we picture as enlightenment. We think enlightenment will be the end of our suffering, but enlightenment abides right in the midst of it. Our suffering will bring it out. We have to get to the bottom of our suffering. Go down all the way to the bottom of it. Then enlightenment springs forth. Dogen says, this very birth and death is itself nirvana. It's not some other place. But this nirvana is the end of suffering. The end of suffering in the midst of what we sometimes call suffering. And maybe another student says, and this might be our feeling too sometimes, I feel like I'm flunking Buddhism over and over. And Sojin Roshi says, me too. We're all in the same boat.
After 50 years.
I'm a failure. We're all failures. But the main thing is not how successful you are at being perfect. I'm not talking about how to be perfect. I'm talking about how to do something completely. That's the main point. If we do our best, that's already an expression of enlightenment. Suzuki Roshi used to say that the people who have the hardest time often turn out to be the most enlightened Zen masters. So you never know. So, great determination and courage to keep going, and that it's okay to be having difficulty, but it's not okay to just give up. We just keep going. I mean, it is actually the practice itself to ultimately give up, but to give up still within our ship of Sesshin that's now getting near the middle of the ocean. Already no land is in sight, and the ocean looks circular. It's very plain out here. But we might have an inkling that the other features of ocean and the shore are infinite in variety. And we may keep discovering the infinite variety of the edges of the ocean and the shore that we can't quite see. I also want to celebrate Suzuki Roshi today because this is his annual Memorial Day. I think people have speculated whether he chose to die on the first period of Rohatsu Sesshin. To get out of it. Maybe to get out of it, but maybe he could have, he was feeling very sick, I think, for a long time, and maybe he could have said the day before. I think that I could imagine him having the feeling that, well, if I go the day before, they're just going to cancel the sesshin and they're going to have to make all these funeral arrangements. But if we get it started, then it's going to be too late to stop it. So, like, I can hang on just a little bit more for one more night. Okay, it started. And maybe also this is his great faith in his students that another Rohatsu Sesshin has started, full of sincere practitioners, and I can go now. And that's what they did, is they just kept sitting. I think some people had to take care of some details, but I think the Sesshin people were told that their teacher had died, and that's what he would have wanted, is them to just keep sitting, so they did. When Koban Shino Roshi, the founder of Santa Cruz Zen Center, died, they also celebrated his life and honored his memorial by, I think it was a 49-day sesshin. Does anybody remember that? Or at Jikoji, they did a very long, long, I think, maybe 3-week, maybe 7-week sesshin. I think most people didn't do the whole thing, but they did it in rounds. People would come for a week and leave, more people would come in, and sesshin just went on and on. I think it might have been Koban's wish. I heard Koto Sawaki Roshi also requested this, and when he died, giant, long, many week sesshin to honor his life. This is a point you maybe heard before. I think another exquisite gem of Zen mind, beginner's mind, on effort. Suzuki Roshi says, strictly speaking, any effort we make is not good for our practice because it creates waves in our mind. It's impossible, however, to attain absolute calmness of our mind without any effort. We must make some effort, but we must forget ourselves in the effort we make. In this realm, there's no subjectivity or objectivity. Our mind is just calm without even any awareness. In this unawareness, every effort and every idea and thought will vanish. So this is jumping a little ahead in our stages of practice, but which we'll talk about when we get to the point of effortless being. But it's necessary for us to encourage ourselves and to make an effort up to the last moment when all effort disappears. You should keep your mind on your breathing until you're not aware of your breathing. And I don't think he means until you just forget about it and get distracted. But keep your mind on your breathing until the awareness is of the whole scene, the whole space, instead of just the breathing. This will be the third subtle Dharma gate of Jir-E, which we'll bring up. a little more a little more Suzuki Roshi. Yes.
For those of us for whom today is the first day, could you just mention what the first two subtle
ways? Yeah, I'll wait till when I start talking about this third one. I'll mention these six subtle Dharma gates of teacher Juryi. This is a talk of Suzuki Roshi where he says the purpose of Sesshin is to be completely one with our practice. And I mentioned that this word Sesshin mean the setsu is to embrace and sustain or to gather and collect the mind or heart. And he has, as often these Chinese characters have multiple intricate meanings. His way of putting it here is this setsu, or ses, means to treat something the way you treat a guest or the way a student treats his teacher, which is a way we can relate to the mind, to treat our mind like an honored guest is what Sesshin is, to take very kind care of it. This is a little bit more about difficulty with pain. In our practice, we rely on something great and sit in that great space. The pain you have in your legs or some other difficulty is happening in that great space. This is kind of like the simpler instruction of just let go, but it's almost a visualization, right? Almost it's opening our mind and our focus into something larger. Sometimes we say, put our attention on the pain and kindly direct our relaxation into the painful knee or butt. And I think that is valuable meditation instruction. But also, possibly at the same time, we can have our larger awareness that's getting very zoomed in on this particular pain. Remember, remembering that the pain and us and the whole Sesshin is held within this great space. As long as you do not lose the feeling that you are in the realm of Buddha nature, you can sit even though you have some difficulty. When you want to escape from your difficulty or when you try to improve your practice, you create another problem for yourself. But if you just exist there, then you have a chance to appreciate your surroundings and you can accept yourself completely without changing anything. That is our practice. To exist in big mind is an act of faith, which is different from the usual faith of believing in a particular idea or being. It's to believe that something is supporting us and supporting all our activities, including thinking mind and emotional feelings. All these things are supported by something big that has no form or color. Which might sound abstract, but it's just a sense that we naturally have, I think, when we're sitting long hours, that something much greater than our little pain is happening here. Completely just sitting may be difficult because of the pain in your legs when you're sitting cross-legged. But even though you have pain in your legs, you can do it. Even though your practice is not good enough, you can do it. Your breathing will gradually vanish. You will gradually vanish, fading into emptiness. Inhaling without effort, you naturally come back to yourself with some color or form. Exhaling, you gradually fade into emptiness, empty white paper. That is shikantaza. The important point is your exhalation. Instead of trying to feel yourself as you inhale, fade into emptiness as you exhale. When you practice this in your last moment, you will have nothing to be afraid of. You're actually aiming at emptiness. You become one with everything after you completely exhale with this feeling. If you're still alive, naturally you will inhale again. Oh, I'm still alive. Fortunately or unfortunately, in the middle of sesshin, then you start to exhale and fade into emptiness. Maybe you don't know what kind of feeling it is, but some of you know it. By some chance, you may have felt this kind of feeling. When you do this practice, you cannot easily become angry. When you're more interested in inhaling than in exhaling, you easily become quite angry. I want to live, but just okay. You mean you're just telling me that, like, I have to, like, change everything now? Fine. You're always trying to be alive when you're inhaling. The other day, my friend had a heart attack, and all he could do was exhale. He couldn't inhale. That was a terrible feeling, he said. At that moment, if he could have practiced exhaling as we do, aiming for emptiness, then I think he would not have felt so bad. The great joy for us is exhaling rather than inhaling. To take care of the exhalation is very important. To die is more important than trying to be alive. When we always try to be alive, we have trouble. Rather than trying to be alive or active, if we can be calm and die or fade away into emptiness, then naturally we will be all right. Buddha will take care of us. The breath continues to just be with us. A little more nuts and bolts, some technical details for today. Again, from Dogen's journals with his teacher in China, called the Hokyoki, the record of the Baojing era in China. Dogen's notes from his conversations. Rujing, Tendo Nyojo, instructed me, when you do zazen, place your tongue on the front roof of your mouth and allow it to press behind the front teeth. Which I think naturally happens, and we've heard this in the Fukan Zazengi. If after 40 or 50 years of zazen practice, you are accustomed to sitting without drooping or becoming drowsy, then it's all right to close your eyes during zazen. I wonder, maybe Blanche Hartman might have logged in 40 or 50 years of zazen practice. That in itself is, you know, almost like, you know, some of you, maybe he's talking to a group where some of them have practiced that long. I would think by the time they're that old, though, they would be like mostly sleeping anyway in zazen. Those who are not so accustomed to zazen, meaning like you haven't sat for 40 years, should sit with the eyes open. If you, so this emphasis. And most Mahayana and Vajrayana meditation practices emphasize eyes open. Staying alert and with the sense gates, not excluding whatever's happening. He also says here, and maybe this could be translated in different ways, but if you sit long and are tired, it's all right to shift the position of your legs. this has been directly transmitted by the Buddha and ancestors for 50 generations. This is the direct transmission. That it's okay to move your legs when you're sitting long and are tired. He doesn't define long. Maybe in those days they sat for, you know, 6 hours without moving or something.
In India, those, I mean, you know, just everybody on the street, I mean, they're up at dawn and they're there in the dark and they seem to sit in their little stall.
Yeah, cross-legged seems to be the cultural sitting position for shopkeepers and so on. Yeah. So, which is nice when they go to meditate, then maybe it's easy. Or maybe it's, you know, maybe they meditate in a chair. So I think we all have to find our own way and fight our own battles and surrender. But I think there's this point, and I think we all know it whenever we do have to move, that that sitting in discomfort is a great encouragement for surrender. And that line where it becomes like, this is ridiculous, this is excruciating, and there's no more, I'm basically just in total survival mode at this point, that's when it's like, we don't need to meditate like that. Although, you know, if we don't feel like we're hurting ourselves, even then, just to put in a little word for, sometimes those moments are like, energetically something, just personally, I felt like something sometimes really shifts at that point. That cool breeze blowing through the hall can sometimes come in those near excruciating moments when we're just like, we just decide, not going to move, but I'm not going to resist. We're just channeled into that funnel of dropping. And I think sometimes if we move too quickly, we miss that opportunity where we're basically like plummeted into letting go, with the hand of the entire universe saying, you know, you will die or let go. So I want to mention the five hindrances to concentration practice, because so far in this session we've been emphasizing settling meditation, calming the mind, and concentrating the mind. We haven't gotten into any insight, nature of reality, teachings and practices. So far, I think when we have, if you're only here for a little bit, for a day or so, then still valuable to really just, it's never a wasted effort to really focus on just the concentration side. And if you feel quite settled, you can open up to other practices. So far we've been emphasizing counting the breath and following the breath. And the hindrances to concentrated meditation are these five hindrances, which are sense desire, the five senses, and their desire. So during Zazen, you know, they're often, I think a lot of them aren't so active. Like visually, it's like, I wish I could look at something other than the wall. We usually don't really think that way. Now sometimes we might get into, I think it's Suzuki Roshi somewhere, that says, sometimes when you're looking at spots on the white wall and you start to like make them into animals and things, he says, that's not Zazen. And
spots in our mind.
That's in a way easier to do. Still, return to the breath. And we could say that would be, you could classify that as the sense desire hindrance. It's like, my visual sensory field is getting so bored with this white wall that it's naturally starting to make animals and I don't know if people have this experience. Ideally, this doesn't happen if we keep our eyes open, but I get my memory of this experience, I think, is during like night sitting where we have the lights off, but the eyes are still open. But if you close your eyes, this can also happen. It's just an effect that can happen after several days of sesshin, usually, where closing the eyes, it's basically like pretty psychedelic visions, like kaleidoscopic lights, and they're somewhat controllable by intention. Like you can like manipulate the kaleidoscopic. How about a little more blue? Yeah, cool. Has anybody ever experienced that?
Soundtrack too,
yeah. At Tassajara, the river can start to be all kinds of songs and voices. And I think this is like sensory deprivation, basically. Our senses are so inactive that they're dying for some stimulation. So I think things like that is not actually the hindrance of visual desire. If we get really into those images and really start playing with them a lot, then it might be like we're actually, trying to create some better visual image. It might fall into that category. But I think usually not such a big thing. So we have eye, ear, the ear sense, desire. I think this one is maybe more prevalent during sesshin. Basically, when we hear sounds, like loud breathing or lots of rustling around, we get very sensitized to little sensory inputs. So it can, the sense desire might be for like quiet. Like there's this sound, it keeps going. I didn't even notice the first day maybe, but now, like maybe it's the heater, this hum of the heater, and like it's torture. You know, that's sense desire disturbing our concentration through the hearing. Nose, probably not so much. Like I wish I could just get a whiff of that sweet incense. I'm way over on the side of the zendo, or I wish that incense would blow the other direction. Not such a big thing. Taste, we might start fantasizing about food during zazen.
So is it aversion too?
Yeah, I think aversion would fit into sense desire. Well, actually, that would be the second hindrance. So sense desire would, taste, and then I think touch is the main one. And touch takes the form of just physical sensations, desire and physical sensations, and it's basically takes the form of like wanting to like get rid of this painful sensation. Again, that might be more like the aversion.
I think my desire to go shopping is visual. I mean, now that I understand that, running through the wetsuits and... I think it's visual.
Yeah, yeah.
Bookstores
with all those different color bindings. Maybe. And maybe it's a mix of various things. And the feeling of the store and the, mental too. But in terms of these five hindrances, they're talking about the five senses and that those five senses are like moving, wanting something other than they have in the moment. And that's like more one of the more gross hindrances. And we just, when it comes up, the practice is just note it and let it go and return. The second one is sometimes called ill will, but I think we could classify it's like the sense aversions could fit in there too, and also just annoyance with other people or whatever is happening. And we can really get, I think this often includes not just the sensory realm, but mental aversion. And this can get pretty big in sesshin. We can really start running stories about how we were wronged last week or last period, whatever. And these are, again, it's just a hindrance to our concentration. So we just notice it, okay, this is like, this doesn't help. My aversion will not fix the situation. My desire will not fix the situation. These are kind of grosser hindrances that maybe you're really struggling with, but I think we can, if we just work on really returning to the breath, those ones tend to settle more and more. And then we have these next two. Those are kind of like a pair, the desire and the aversion. And then when that grosser pair kind of settles, we have that next pair of distraction and restlessness, distraction, worry, agitation mind, sometimes just physical energy of restlessness, and the opposite of sloth, torpor, dullness, fading, hazy. Those are subtler hindrances that when the desire and aversion are somewhat temporarily subdued, then these next two come up, and they can be very subtle. It might not be total racing mind or total sleeping, but I think in the subtle form, it's just like we're on the breath, and the little things that pull us off one side or the other are often these. A little restless might just be like, yeah, just a little feeling. A little dullness is just like I lost the number, and I don't know what I was thinking about at that time. I'm not even really feeling sleepy, but I'm not like totally attentive to each breath. So I think this will be throughout a whole session. I think we can continue working with this restless worry mind, little agitation mind, and the dullness. You know, the edge is gone, the hazy, a little too relaxed mind, and just stay on that middle way that's relaxed but totally alert and attentive. And then the fifth hindrance is doubt. It's a hindrance to, these are hindrances not to enlightenment or something more exalted like that, but they're just hindrances to concentration in meditation. And doubt is the one that in a way maybe most subtle of all, because it could take a big form of like really questioning, like after a few days of sesshin, like, why am I doing this again? This is like same old thing over and over, and I feel pretty settled, and I'm just here, and like, okay, like enough? Can we stop now? Or isn't something good supposed to happen? Like, what is this practice anyway, and how did I get myself into this? Those could be the doubts, or there could be doubts about more specifics of the meditation. Like, I'm just really settled, and none of these other four hindrances are really affecting me. I'm in the groove, I'm just on the breath, I'm just dying on the exhale, and this little doubt comes up of, is this like Buddha's enlightenment, or am I just like having a nice energetic flowing time here? Is this really the whole thing? Maybe these Zen people are fooling us when they say that practice and verification are not two. Maybe this is just practice. Is this Buddha's great realization, or is this just calming meditation? And these could be valid doubts, because what I want to keep exploring over these next days is the subtle differences between energetic, calm, shamatha meditation and the practice and verification of the Buddhas. Yes?
I have a question about that, which is, there's kind of like that tendency to analyze the
Yeah.
Trying to mentally analyze it.
Like, how am I doing?
But at the same time, then you went on to say, but we need somehow to be, you know, I see that tendency of like, okay, what is this? And then it seems to move me away from my experience. Hmm. On the other hand, what's this second point? point of actually knowing, I don't know, say what you said again.
About doubt?
About after doubt, but there's a way that we kind of keep ourselves on track or know that part.
Yeah, I think doubt as a hindrance is when we're questioning so extremely that we're undermining our continuous effort. We're saying like maybe this really is off track, and it totally pulls us. We start getting totally distracted, and like maybe my whole practice is off, and like this whole breath thing. What's breath? Following the breath got to do with Buddha's enlightenment anyway. And then to keep going with that in the sense that, well, now I'm not even going to follow the breath. Now I'm just going to like get assaulted by this doubt instead of just, for now, we're just going to do it. And there is room, I think, that's not doubt for checking where we're at in the meditation. And so to talk about this, settling, calming, shamatha meditation. Shamatha means calm abiding. So it has these factors of mindfulness, settledness, ease, and alertness. And they're all kind of aspects of the same mind, but we can distinguish between them. So mindfulness is the main thing that's just staying present. Mindfulness is the mind being present and being directed towards the object of meditation if we're using the breath. And the subtleness is not getting too rigid about this, to keep the relaxation is the key. Shamatha means calm. It's a state of settledness, but the mindfulness is keeping the mind in the present, and then alertness is a little bit like checking. It could be a slightly like a little conversation, not much of one, but just like we're mindful and present, but then like the alertness can ask. Is this kind of dull here? Am I like actually kind of spaced out a little bit? Like I'm just sitting, but if I were to try to count my breath, there's no way I could do it right now. Even though I'm very relaxed and I'm kind of present, the alertness factor can come in there and say like, is this really brightly, clearly present? It's so the alertness is kind of directing things. So one metaphor, one of my Tibetan teachers uses is the doorman for this calming meditation, that you're like a doorman in a hotel, and mindfulness is like the doorman just standing there watching people go in and out, and the settledness is the overall container. The doorman is just standing there. Their job is to just, you know, they're not doing anything. They're just standing there, relaxed, and they're watching the people go in and out. Like the breath. People like a breath after breath. And the alertness is actually really attending to like each person completely going through. We're not just like letting them go through, watching it happen, but you know, checking each person and whether they're we could even say whether they're supposed to be in this hotel. So we're like, yeah, this is a guest. They're showing us their room card or something, and then wait a second. This is a door-to-door salesman. They're actually not supposed to come into this hotel, and the alertness catches that that this is not the breath now. This is a rabbit.
I just
brought up that sometimes I noticed in my meditation when I was trying to really count the breath, could be quite concentrated, but and without a lot of like big long storyline, but just the more subtle it is, the more random seeming the images can become. So just like, you know, it's like between 3 and 4, there's like a little rabbit running across. And there's no real story about it. It doesn't mean anything. I don't get all obsessed about it, but it's enough to miss 4. Or it's enough to be like, oh, I was just on 3 and like, where? Yeah. So it must be time for 4 now. But actually, there's something more about this rabbit, like,
or ants,
kind of, you know, like just little, very little, almost dreamlike, just you know, images.
I got up to 14. You know, like I'll fall.
That's another thing that can happen. It's when you get to 10, you just keep going. Yeah. So and then whoa. So it's part of this. Counting to 10 thing is knowing when to stop and then begin again. So the just about these 5 hindrances. So this is an early teaching of Buddha, and we sometimes don't bring this up in Zen instructions because it's just a early Buddhist teaching about just concentrating the mind, and shikantazas, we think way beyond this, you know, just working with the 5 hindrances, because it's about like just being in Buddha mind right now. But this is, I think, a nice point from Nyan Dogen's conversations with his teacher. He has this question himself, because he's heard all these Zen teachings about like, just be Buddha right now. So he says, Ru Jing says, practicing Zen is dropping off body and mind. And as we chant, without depending on incense burning, bowing, chanting Buddha's name, repentance, or reading scriptures, you should just wholeheartedly sit. As we chant at noon service. And then I, Dogen, asked, what is dropping off body and mind? Yeah, what is that? Ru Jing said, dropping off body and mind is zazen. Oh, come on. When you just sit, shikantaza, you are free from the 5 sense desires and the 5 hindrances. So he brings up this old teaching. And then I, Dogen, asked, is this freedom from 5 sense desires and 5 hindrances the same as what the sutra schools are talking about? Does it mean we are to be practitioners of both the Mahayana and Hinayana? Because, you know, we're Mahayana, but isn't this just like a Hinayana teaching about eliminating desires and so on? And Ru Jing says, descendants of the ancestors should not exclude the teachings of either vehicle, the small or the great vehicle. If students ignore the Tathagata's sacred teachings, how can they become descendants of Buddha ancestors? And I asked, recent critics say that the 3 poisons, greed, hate, and delusion, are themselves Buddha Dharma, and the 5 sense desires are nothing but the ancestral way. They say that trying to become free of them is dualistic discrimination, no different from the Hinayana way. What do you think about this? And there are Zen teachings that say this. Beautiful and authentic Zen teachings that, like Dogen saying that birth and death is itself nirvana, and the Shinshin Ming, the part that we don't chant, mentions that the 5 sense desires are themselves innately pure and so on. But Ru Jing at this point says, if we don't try to free ourselves from the 3 poisons and the 5 sense desires, we would be practicing like people outside the way. if Buddhas and ancestors, descendants become free from even one moment of hindrance or desire, it will be a great benefit. To do this is to encounter Buddha ancestors. So, really straightforward. This is not the non-dual teaching at this point. We have the non-dual teaching, but at this point he's telling Dogen, just let go of these hindrances. And then later they have another conversation about this. What Ru Jing says outright, descendants of the Buddha ancestors should first be free from the five hindrances and then become free from the sixth hindrance. The sixth hindrance is the lack of understanding, or basic ignorance. I don't think the Buddha ever taught this, but I think he's making this up now. He's saying, it's not just about being free from the five hindrances. This is the wisdom part. When you're free from the hindrance of lack of understanding, you immediately become free from the five hindrances. But if you're not free from the hindrance of the lack of understanding, even though you're free from the five hindrances, you do not arrive at the practice and realization of the Buddha ancestors. So this issue of basic misunderstanding about reality, if we clear that up, then the five hindrances drop away on their own. I bowed with gratitude, respectfully folding my hands across my chest and said, I have never heard of this teaching before. A lot of senior monks and brother monks don't seem to know or talk about it. It must be that I have good roots from the past that enabled me today to hear for the first time this compassionate teaching. Master, please tell me further, what is the secret of being free from all these hindrances and the six hindrances? Being free from the five hindrances and the six hindrances. Ru Jing smiled and replied, haven't you been practicing all along? What you've already been doing is exactly the way to be free from the six hindrances. Buddhas and ancestors do not wait for people to pass through various stages. They directly and personally transmit the way to be free from the six hindrances, so we're no longer controlled by the five sense desires. The practice of just sitting, shikantaza, and dropping off body and mind is the way to become free from the five hindrances and the five sense desires. There's no other way, and there's no point in talking about any other way. So there's this little issue about this sixth hindrance here that I think falls into the Vipassana category, so we won't get into today. But working with these five, sense desire, ill will, aversion, restlessness, worry, which may have not even much content, but just be like antsiness, dullness, sloth, torpor, hopeless maybe. And it could fit into that. And then doubt. Doubt could also get close to hopeless. Doubt about our own ability to actually sit here. It's getting kind of late. I could mention about the next Dharma Gate just briefly, if you'd like. There's one nod. Okay, we're into it now. We have time for zazen later. Juri was this, for those who weren't here past days, was this Chinese teacher around the time of Bodhidharma in the 6th century, the founder of the Tiantai school, who wrote many meditation manuals that influenced Dogen and the Zen school. And there's one called the Six Subtle Dharma Gates, or the Six Dharma Gates to the Sublime. And it's on six ways of relating to the breath. And the first one's called counting, which is counting the breath in sets of 10, which I was proposing that we do for the whole first day. And I found quite humbling to try. So if you're arriving today, you're welcome to practice counting the breath for 24 hours. And then the second Dharma gate is following, which means following the breath. And the way that they transition is that when one's counting, one state of mind becomes very subtle and still, and one becomes concerned that counting has become a coarse activity. One does not want to engage in counting anymore. At that time, the practitioner can just let loose of the counting and proceed to cultivate following. And then following is just following the breath in and out. One relinquishes the previous dharma of counting and just follows the breath. So the realization of following is, since the mind has become fine and subtle, it becomes peaceful, still, and free from any disorderliness. One becomes aware of the breath as now long, as now short, and so on. The mind and the breath carry on in a state of mutual interdependence. It's like when mind and breath, almost like you can't distinguish. You're aware of the breathing, but it becomes less and less like there's you and the breathing, or the awareness and the breathing. You're just mind and the breath are just, in a way, fused together, or completely interdependent, and just flowing along together. And I don't think this means that we never miss a breath. I don't think this is, you know, it may be impossible. Maybe you cannot miss for a while. But we're basically with it. So again, I think, I explained how I decided I was going to see if I could get through very clearly 3 rounds of 10 and the counting, then I would go on to the following. And very challenging. And so you could make up your own. If you're a really concentrated person and that's not so challenging, then you could just go right on to following. Or say, do 100 sets of 10 and then without missing, and then go on to following. But I think there is some joy in letting go of the coarseness of these numbers and just following without a word in the form of a number. Next, one becomes aware of following as a coarse activity. The mind becomes averse to it and wishes to relinquish it. This is analogous to when a person has become exhausted and desires to sleep, thus causing him to be disinclined to deal with his many tasks. In other words, even following becomes like a burdensome task, kind of a chore. Counting can really seem like a chore. Now following even seems like, this is like, you know, I'm very still, present, alert. We have these 3 qualities of mindfulness, alertness, and relaxation, ease. And and now, like, it seems like extra to even be following the breath. Then one can relinquish following and cultivate stopping, or stabilization, or shamatha, or the state of just calm abiding. As for the cultivation of stopping, one puts to rest all thought, taking anything as an object. So the breath is an object when we're following the breath. When stopping, the mind doesn't take anything as an object. One does not engage in either counting or following. One fixes the mind and makes it still. This is what's meant by the cultivation of stopping or stabilization. As for the realization of stopping, one becomes aware of the body and mind seeming to vanish entirely as one enters into meditative absorption. Which sounds similar to the body and mind dropping off. I would propose this is still not Dogen's dropping off body and mind. but it's our sense of, our rougher sense of body and mind is, gets very refined, and this is maybe what some people would call shikantaza, just sitting, is we're no longer have any object, specific object like the breath, we're just resting in the present. Johnny had this term called dynamic stillness. We're very still, not focused on any particular thing, but it's dynamic. And sometimes we could say there's no object, but I would say there's no particular object, but there still is object.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This third piece here seems to me very close to the realization of impermanence and epicolizing.
Mm.
And the dynamics I'm talking about is the sense that there is no permanent form. Everything is always transforming. There is no fixation, no object in that sense.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to put it, is that it's very close. And in terms of these six subtle dharma gates, the next, you know, the two middle ones, this one's called stopping or shamatha, the next one's called seeing or vipassana. And that would be like when you're actually realizing impermanence, for example. So they're very close, but not exactly. It's still, in this text, they're distinguishing. This is just experiencing the present. And if we say objectless meditation, I think it's, in this case, more accurate to say there is an object, but the object is what we call the present. And it's not a fixed thing, like the breath is very specific, which is why the breath is so good to use, because we can find it very easily, whereas the present is a little bit hard to find unless we're very, very alert and awake. Another way to put it is resting in nowness. And then we might think, well, does this mean focusing on what is our experience of now? Well, it's five senses, we might say. Is it focusing on the color of now or the sound that just came? And again, this Tibetan teacher, Sokni Rinpoche, who came up with the doorman metaphor, he presents this shamatha like this, resting in nowness. And the question came up to him is, does this mean like focusing on the sense object arising in the present, like the sound comes and you focus on the sound? And I thought he was going to say yes. But he said, no, actually, it's focusing on the sense of nowness. And it includes the sensory input. It includes sounds. Sounds are coming in, but we're not actually focusing on sound as an object. It's more like Suzuki Roshi's, we're sitting in this field or this space, bigger space, and the sense of overall nowness, it's a little more vague than an object, but it's also very specific, right now. So the alertness is like, is there veering even slightly into like the last breath or the next breath? Or is it just like right now and there's little sounds happening, there's definitely sensations happening, and but we're like on the cutting edge of our life right now. And that, I think it brings forth a well of energy sitting this way too. And it might seem like, well, that sounds great. I'd be happy to just practice that way forever. But just to not limit ourselves to anything in the vast enlightenment of the Buddhas, that even this is still called shamatha. It's still just calm abiding as opposed to vipassana. And when vipassana and shamatha are united, that's like Buddha's mind. But for now, if you feel pretty settled, and you can try this however settled you are and see how it goes. Again, very personal, very intuitive, creative, individual thing. If you feel like pretty with the breath, you can relinquish the breath and just sit on the resting in the present, attending alertly to nowness. And it doesn't mean like one or the other. You can go back and forth. If you're in nowness but you start getting dull, then go back to the breath, back to following. If even following is like, whoa, after a meal or something, sometimes like, okay, just back to counting. What I've been doing is even just starting periods with a round of 10, just like see how the counting's going, then like release the counting, follow for a while, and then sometimes that's enough. Sometimes the period's over, and there are a lot of rabbits and other stuff like, oh, really? Okay, we never got really past, where was I? Sometimes it's like this. We have many periods to experiment with our concentration. But sometimes, we don't even know all the conditions that go into it, but everything seems lined up, and we're just present, and the pain is not, the physical pain's manageable, and we can just let that be its own practice. It's working like that. That butt pain is just doing its own thing down there. It's part of the field, and we're just breathing. And then sometimes, if we feel really settled, then we can just slide into that no particular object. And I think unless we're very, very alert, I think we often fall off this pretty quickly, which is okay. And then just we can come back to it, or come back to breath, or anything. So, but it's nice to distinguish that so far we have these three different Dharma gates. You could practice them all like distinctly and not mix them into it helps relieve our doubt hindrance maybe. Okay, I'm doing this practice, this one, or this one right now. And one period of meditation could include all three, but we can set an intention. What am I working on now? Okay, we better stop. Is there any other, last minute clarifications of any of this? If all this seems too complicated, just let go. Dedicate any merit and virtue arising from this practice to the complete awakening of all beings. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.